Hello there, everyone, and welcome to episode 5 of season 3 of Psyched to Be With You. This episode, I am psyched to be with you, Arni Valkarma, attempting to say it in a Finnish dialect, which many English speakers, including myself, can't do. Arni is the head of Keeping On Brand at Super Rare Games, an incredibly cool indie game publisher. In this episode, we talk about pretty much all of what that involves, because, you know, like I said, there's a lot going on. Anime booty picks, Final Fantasy, powerlifting, and a whole bunch of other stuff. But I think one of the things I really want to highlight is we had a really cool discussion about what it's like to come over to the UK and study and work, and a really cool discussion about, you know, what it's like being from a working class background in the games industry. All this, the usual jokes, shenanigans, and much more. I hope you enjoyed this one as much as I did. All the links wherever you found this episode. Enjoy it. Hello there, everyone, and welcome back to episode 5 of season 3. For those that like fingers to help them count, of Psyched to Be With You. I'm incredibly excited for this episode. My guests, they are absolutely legendary, adding yet more to the plethora of beautiful accents that I've had on this show that I'm incredibly shared to share with you all. We're going to once again hear some incredible things. I'm going to stop blabbing on because this isn't, it's my podcast, but it's not about me. My very special guest, if you could please just introduce yourself and tell us who you are and what you do.
Brilliant. So my name is Arni Valkarma, or if we were to pronounce it correctly, but very few English-speaking people actually can. In Finnish, we would say Arni Valkarma, but either way works. Most people use Arni. So yeah, I work in the video games industry. I am currently at Super Rare Games. So I work at Super Rare Games as a head of Keeping On Brand. So at Super Rare Games, we're all kind of ahead of something. But what that means in kind of proper business terms is that I do a bit of PR, I do bits of branding, and I do bits of marketing. And it took me, oh dear, 3 years to break into the video games industry. It's always been kind of a passion field for me, but I didn't actually realize that I could turn my passion for gaming into something I could actually earn a paycheck from. So originally, I am from Finland, it is a big city by Finnish standards, but when I grew up, I didn't even consider gaming as something that I could turn into a career, really. I don't know how it is these days, but at least back when, so I was born in 1997, so I'm 26 years old, but back when I was a kid, gaming was still very much the kind of hobby that got looked down upon. Like, you get those kind of stereotypes of, like, oh, someone who is incredibly antisocial, doesn't work, lives in their mom's basement kind of thing. So when I was growing up, I was often told that I should not mention gaming as my hobby because it would kind of create those negative connotations. So a lot of my childhood was like thinking like, oh, gaming isn't really a hobby. Like, your hobby is a thing that's things like, oh, you do football, or you do rugby, or you play ice hockey, or something, you know, social, where you go about and meet other people. So that's in a long-winded way of who I am and why I do what I do.
Love it. Getting really straight into the heart of the podcast. We'll end the episode there. No, I'm joking. okay, so that's great. So just your job title again, head of Keeping On Brand?
Yes.
That sounds like a great way of getting you to do more than one job for only one paycheck.
Yeah, I mean... So Super Rare Games is a really kind of young company. So it turned 5 this year. So it's only started quick maths. I was good at maths in school. 2018 Super Rare Games started. And it started out kind of like a limited physical games publisher. So people may have heard of companies like Limited Run Games, Strictly Limited. So we were kind of in that same sphere initially. And for like the first 4-ish years of Super Rare Games, that's all we really did. But in the last year in January 2022, we announced our kind of original publishing label. And our workload has kind of grown tremendously since then, because now we still do the limited physical publishing stuff, but now we also do original stuff. So And we're still quite a small team, so as it comes with small teams, we do kind of juggle bits and pieces. But at Superia, we've been quite lucky in the last year that our marketing team has like doubled. I used to look after, for example, all our social media stuff, but now we have a dedicated community manager who just does all that.
Okay, well that's excellent. I think, it's a really interesting way to sort of look at things, and you touched on this yourself. I remember sort of being in even college, sort of that sort of 16 to 18 period as we refer to it here, and like being told, well, you're Chris, you're never going to get into the games industry. People that are doing that are going to have been doing it their whole life and are never going to stop. And that was in 2010, so like just before indie games like became a thing. That's why I never sort of pursued games as a career, which is why I choose to research them instead, because I thought that was a nice
Mean
workaround.
sounds very exciting, though.
You don't know many academics, do you?
So to be fair, to go on that point, so before I joined video games, I worked at Oxford University Press and I worked in academic publishing. So while I didn't work with academics directly, I worked with librarians a lot. And before I went into that job, I actually did work in like higher education, not as a teacher, but I worked at the university I graduated from. So I have some experience in the like academic field, just not directly.
In which case, I apologize. I meant to burn myself and inadvertently burned you. Also, I'm sorry for your time at Oxford. That's a classicist joke because, the South, and I'm from Liverpool. For regional listeners that don't quite get that joke, you laughed, and that's all that matters because you're the
Yeah, yeah, I mean, for
Also,
me,
I
because I'm
mean,
not from.
academic publishing, I'm trying to work out if that makes you the bad guy or not.
Well, if it makes you feel better, I didn't really feel like I fit in my role in particular, because well, if you are watching this podcast, you can see how I look like, and I don't exactly look like the kind of person you may think when you're thinking of someone who works at Oxford University Press. So I was definitely a bit of a black sheep in the marketing team there.
For the benefit of the listeners, would you be comfortable describing yourself?
Yeah, so I would describe myself as goth. So I have longish green hair. I have a side shave on one side of my hair. I wear quite strong makeup. I have black eyeliner, dark lipstick, and I am currently wearing like a collared top that has a lovely, very family-friendly picture of some sort of demonic creature.
Lovely. So very, I'd say that's actually very suitable for Oxford University Press. More jokes. Okay, lovely. I realised I'd never actually asked anyone to describe themselves before. That was actually quite strange. Good job. I do believe you refer to yourself as a strong goblin.
Yes, yeah. So, yeah, I don't. I think the goblin part comes from the fact that I do have green hair. Literally, nothing else to do with the fact that it's goblin. I just think of goblins and they're green. And I like taking slight kind of dicks at myself every now and then. It's healthy to be able to laugh at yourself, you know.
So, I
And
mean,
yes,
you're
strong.
basically British if you can self-deprecate. That's how we live.
I think Finland and UK might have that in common.
Exquisite.
But yeah, for the strong part, it's probably something I might talk a bit more later, depending on how the conversation goes. But yeah, so the strong part comes from the fact that one of the things I do outside of games is that I am actually a power lifter. It's a something I am pursuing quite seriously at the moment. I'm actually hoping to eventually compete. So yeah, that's where the kind of strong goblin thing comes from, and then people online have just kind of rolled with it.
So you heard it here first, exclusively on this show. Annie will be on World's Strongest Person in a few years.
Oh dear.
Olympics, maybe?
Yeah, who knows? If games doesn't work out, I'll just become an Olympic athlete because it's easy. You just do it, really.
I mean, in this economy, let's be honest, you need to do both jobs.
Oh yeah.
It's funny because it's cripplingly true. Anywho, so. So we've met a couple of times. I sort of know you through sort of Safe in Our World. We were at the Halloween party charity event together. That was cool. You and
Yes.
Rosie, also a previous guest on the show. Shout out to Rosie, legend. We're a Kim Possible duo costume. Incredible.
Yeah.
But this chat kind of came about because you were sort of talking about on Twitter about sort of being from working class backgrounds, which obviously is something that resonated with me. I very much frequently, I like to frame it as in checking my privilege, but also really shouting about the fact that I'm working class, very passionate about that, and getting into the games industry. So you mentioned a few other jobs there. Can we sort of go back a little bit and talk about that career plan? Like, why did we go through those steps? Why did we want to get into games beyond it being cool?
Yeah, of course. So, my family background is that I do come from a working class family. I know there's a lot of privilege in the fact that I was lucky enough to kind of be born and grow up in Finland, where obviously the social care and things are a lot better.
I do apologize to interrupt you there. for benefit of just someone who clearly is too privileged to know, I feel like we should explain what working class is. Because like the class system in Britain is in of itself a thing, right? We could have a debate about that. But like essentially it means that, you know, like you're typically both your parents had to work to make ends meet. you were expected to get a job typically as soon as you could to assist the household, that kind of thing. There's a lot more nuance to it, but like, you know, the emphasis was that you'd have to work. Is that a fair definition?
Yeah, I think there's no like universal definition for working class. The one that I kind of learned at school is similar to kind of what you said, and it's largely people who work things. They work like, well, they work paycheck to paycheck. They may work part-time or things like that. And generally, they are people who work those kind of, I guess, quote-unquote, blue-collar, physical labor type of jobs.
Much better. See, I was like, we're going to have this whole discussion. It'll be great. Did not look up any definitions. Didn't think about it. Because I was like, I know what this means. Like, we could just spend 90 minutes dunking on Tories. That'd be great. So, like, we did not get in some of the nuances there. apologies. So, Finland, growing up.
Yes. Yeah. So I grew up in Finland in a working class family. We, like I said, I was lucky in the sense that I was born in Finland. I would not have gotten all the opportunities that I have if I hadn't been born in Finland, because my family simply would not have been able to provide me with the kind of opportunities that I have had. Like, if we lived in the UK, no way could my family put me in a private school, which seems like a necessity in some parts of the UK if you want to get into a good university. So I lucky in that sense. But yeah, at the same time, my family did struggle quite a bit growing up. So my mom was a single mom for a little while, taking care of me. And I have a older half-sister who is 6 years older than me. She's in her 30s now. But then kind of my stepdad stepped into the picture when I was about 2-3 years old, and he's been around ever since. But yeah, growing up. So first of all, in my family, I am currently in my immediate family, the only person who has, first of all, even graduated high school or college, whatever it's called in the UK. In Finland, we call it the upper secondary school, which sounds very fancy. But I was the first person to even do that. And then I kind of won up that by then getting myself a university degree, and not only getting myself a university degree, but getting my degree in a foreign country. So it's been a hard life, but I always loved studying. Unfortunately, I went through a childhood where I was bullied quite a lot. First it started, so I'm wearing glasses. I've been cross-eyed my entire life, so that's the thing, that's what started my bullying when I was younger. Then I was quite a bit heavier than all the other kids, so then people started bullying my weight. So kind of when I was a kid, I felt like, okay, my smarts is the only thing I have, so I'm going to focus on that.
I resonate with that on pretty much every level at this point. so just wanted to share that there. Like, yeah, this is bringing back a lot of memories.
Oh, I'm sorry, but at the same time, it's not.
It's not fine, but it's not your fault. It's okay.
Yeah. But yeah, like I mentioned, I graduated upper secondary school or high school in 2016 when I was 19. And pretty much the summer after that, I moved to the UK. But even prior to that, so first of all, because of my family background, there was no support they were able to provide me in terms of like moving to a different country. So I started working when I was 17 years old. And the little known fact about Finland is that while we have free free schooling for kids, by the point you get to high school, you don't actually get your books. And I believe nowadays you are even required to have a laptop. I believe there might be some funding opportunities for students who cannot buy themselves a laptop. But when I was in school, we had to buy our own books. And obviously, because of
Hidden
my background,
capitalism. Lovely.
yes. Yeah. You can buy them secondhand. They were still very expensive. So my mom couldn't always pay the books I needed. So I started working at the age of 17. A lot of my friends thought it was like, ooh, you have so much disposable income. But it was literally to pay for my education. So I worked, my career path, I guess, started as a housekeeper. I worked at a very high-end hotel, which was an experience in and of its own, coming from a poor background,
There's going to be some
making sure that
stories we
the.
can get into there.
Oh boy, I have loads of stories about that time. So I worked in a hotel for about just under 2 years. And then before my graduation, I quit that job because I've had enough. It was too much work, too little pay, and the hours, we worked overtime hours all the time. But then throughout that summer before I moved, I then did like a summer job. I worked as a cleaner at a local college. And much more pleasant because the students weren't around. We were basically just making sure the school was in tip-top shape when the students came back in August. But yeah, following that, I then moved to the UK in September of 2019. So 2019, 2016, sorry. So I have now lived here for 7 years, and people frequently ask me, why on earth have you stuck around?
It's a valid question.
I can go into that a bit more. But yeah, so I moved here and I went to do my degree at Loughborough University, which people immediately start to think, ooh, sports, ooh, engineering. I did neither of those. My degree was in history and international politics, hence why I have familiarity with how to define the working class. So yeah, and again, well, that degree has nothing to do with my job now, but I very much enjoyed my degree. I've always approached education I did my degree, and that also had ups and downs because I was completely reliant on a student loan I got from Finland, which is currently a pain in my neck to pay back because the payments are very different to the UK system. But during my degree, I went through basically every single summer my student loan payments would end, and because I lived in East Midlands in a small town that was primarily the businesses were up kept by students. So in the summer, when students weren't around, they wouldn't really hire staff, part-time staff. And even with my 3 years of experience as a cleaner, even those jobs wouldn't even interview me. So make of that what you will.
Definitely not to
So
do with like a systematic racism problem in the UK or anything.
No, no,
I
absolutely.
think I also just want to quickly just for perspective, like moving cities in the UK is seen as a big thing for university. You don't want to go too far from home. So I think it's an absolute baller move to just be, yeah, I'm gonna go to a country, just with that, no sort of like monetary support, and just do the thing that like that takes, some big old math rocks to do, especially when like again, it's worth pointing out, but like international students are charged more than home students in the UK for tuition fees and things like that. So like, it's a big decision, but it has even more gravitas, I think, when you hear people that have had that experience.
Yeah, absolutely. And then there's also some kind of connotations that came with that because obviously the immediate assumption is okay, international student, they have the wealthy parents that have placed them here. Whilst for me, it was the total opposite. I genuinely like my family was maybe during the summers where my income completely ended, they could give me, I don't know, 50 euros, 100 euros here and there. But I genuinely went through summers. Like the first summer after my first year of university, I had £200 for the entire summer, so that was 3 months. My landlord was lovely enough to let me pay my rent very delayed when my student loan payments kicked in again in September. But I went through that entire summer with basically £200 on my account, and that's what I have for that entire period.
As we would call that heavy salad. But again, I mean, you did the thing. You managed. You were driven by like the passion to want to stay and to want to do the thing, which I think is really commendable. If you were going to do a master's, what would you do it in? That's a question.
So my undergraduate dissertation was on kind of Japanese history. I've always been really passionate about Japan as a culture, as a country, the history, the language, just all nine yards. And unsurprisingly, I'm also into anime, but it's more than just the usual, like, oh, I like pretty pictures. I just like Japan is very fascinating to me. So I did my dissertation.
Hold on. People hear anime, they go, oh, like Yu-Gi-Oh, like Dragon Ball, but like, yeah, like, no, booty pics. It's not just the booty pics. I'm now beginning to think maybe it is the booty pics.
It depends on the mood, you know. There's a lot of genres to anime.
Yes, there is.
But yeah, so I did my dissertation on Japanese history, was specifically the World War II era. In my second year, I did wrote like an essay about the kind of, this is where a trigger warning would come in, but like the sex slavery during World War II. So I discovered that kind of he's part of Japan in my second year of uni, and I was like, oh, this is fascinating. We don't really talk about that aspect of Japan, because when you talk about Japanese history during World War II, I was like, okay, so they dropped the atomic bomb there, so they're more a bit more like the victims, but there's actually quite a lot of stuff that happened during the war. And then I kind of tied that period into kind of Japanese national identity. So if you talk about the World War history in Japan these days, especially like the conservative government there, they have very, some of them just outright deny that some of the things happened. Some of they insist that they have already like compensated the countries that fell victim to these crimes. There's a lot of heated debate there, and it still very much impacts how kind of like Japan's relations with China, South Korea, and like Philippines, all these countries. So that's a long-winded way of saying if I went to do my master's, I would probably do it in something like Japanese studies. Whether that would be the language or again culture or history, that's up in the air.
So I was gonna say, that sounds really cool, and then realize I need to preface that with not the horrible war crimes, but the doing that as a master's subject. Because I mean, like, and I say this as a Brit, people like to position themselves as good or bad, when in actual fact, whenever you get to war, pretty much everyone is probably the bad guy.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because that's how war works. I actually had a conversation with someone just the other day, and I was doing this sort of very British, profusely apologizing for nothing thing, and the message was like in all caps, it was like, "Quit being so British," and I instantly just replied with, "I'm not trying to colonize anyone." Too much aplomb,
Oh dear.
because I think I'm funny. They thought it was funny. It was a great time, but like that's how Brits operate. So I also want to point out like I love Japan as well. It's on like my bucket list to visit. One of the things I definitely want to do. I think I do not know as much. I'm gonna clarify that, but I've always been fascinated by the country and the culture and things like that, and obviously it's the home of so much gaming content that I enjoy as well.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
So we've gone through like undergraduate degree, you stayed in the UK, you mentioned a few of those sort of like jobs. At what point did you realize that it was games, and how did you go about getting into games?
So after my second year of uni, my university by default offered the option of doing like a placement year, so working in the industry for a year. So I was like, okay, I'll look into this. Although it's notoriously difficult to find a placement job with kind of my degree background, unless you're going into something like trying to apply to work at the parliament or some other like bureaucratic institution. So it was then that when I was looking around, and it just kind of randomly popped into my head, was like, oh, I wonder if any like games companies offer any placements. And I believe I applied for. So EA back then offered a placement. Placements. I don't know if they do still, but they offered them then. Obviously, I didn't get it. But it was kind of from that point on that I then started thinking, and especially when my final year of uni kicked in, I was like, huh, I don't really know what I want to do specifically, but it would be amazing if it was in video games. So it kind of was like, I'd say December of my final year of university, so this was late 2018, that I started then applying for games industry jobs. And it was from that point until December of 2021 when I finally got my current job that I'm at Super Rare Games. But in between, which is going to divert the topic, but I was homeless for a little while. So the day I graduated university with my first class honors degree, I was actually homeless at
GG.
that point.
On the degree, just for clarification.
So I was very lucky that I was able to stay with friends during that period that I was homeless. But yeah, I did not have a home of my own. I did not have money, and I was constantly looking for jobs. Funnily enough, I had the same situation happen twice. So as in, like, I wasn't homeless twice, but so when I was homeless, I was applying for two jobs. One was an internship at the university I graduated from, and the other one was a games industry job at a company. won't name which company. But I actually had to pull out of that application process, even though it was quite promising because I was offered the internship. And at that point, I really had to w decide between, okay, I can have this job guaranteed, I can get money, I can get my own place again, and like, or do I keep pursuing this thing that might not lead into anything? So that happened once. And then the following year, when the pandemic started, which is a whole other topic, my internship was approaching an end, and I was again just relentlessly applying for games jobs. And there was an internship in games again in an unnamed company. Haven't heard many good things about said company. But yes, there was
That
an
narrows it
internship where I was up.
down. Not very
Yeah.
much.
Yes.
jokes.
Yeah. So there was an internship I was applying for, and then the Oxford University Press, a marketing assistant position, and that was offered to me. So again, it was between, okay, I can take this job now and start getting paid again, or do I keep up with this interview process? I could have probably accepted the job and still kept up with the interview process, but at that point, it was mid-pandemic. I was very tired, very depressed. I'd been applying for jobs for months. So at that point, I was like, okay, I'm going to take this job now and just do it for a little while.
Well, I think a really important point there is, and this is going to tie into, I think, talking about some of the working class elements in this kind of processing. But like, firstly, it takes a lot of effort and a lot of time to pursue jobs and applications and interviews, and obviously maybe less applicable during the pandemic time. But like, there's sometimes a cost benefit as well. Like
Oh,
people
yeah.
might want you to go to an in-person interview. That's travel, depending on where it is. Like you need accommodation and like. You're still kind of like rolling the dice at that point, which is, I think, particularly when you've had an offer that is a in-ink offer, it's really hard to choose between like essentially like some semblance of security or hope. So, I feel like I'm kind of getting wax lyrical, but how did you think like your living situation was like a okay, I can put the dreams on hold. I can keep pursuing this later because you're like you felt like you had to pick the job kind of thing.
Yeah, so on in the first instance, it was obvious I was homeless, I was staying with friends, so I was like, I felt they genuinely did not mind, but in a way you will feel bad. You're like, I am here, I am contributing, I'm paying no bills, I am barely even paying my own food, so you don't kind of wanna not like overstay your welcome, so to speak. So that was the case in the first instance. I just needed to get on my feet again. And in the second instance, it was again, the pandemic. So 2020 was a really rough year for me in general. I'd say it was probably the toughest year of my life. I lived alone. I got furloughed from my internship in March. I was basically in total isolation during the toughest of the lockdowns. I had no human interactions with anyone. I was completely by myself. So in I did a lot of kind of disaster thinking in that period, basically unwillingly. And when it approached the kind of end of my internship, like the last month of my internship, I was lucky enough to keep getting paid while I was furloughed because I did work at the university. By get to got to the last month of internship with I still didn't have a job, so I was like, oh my God, if I don't have a job when my internship ends, I'm an immigrant in this country. I will not be able to pay my rent. All my friends who were still at uni have now graduated. They have moved out of Loughborough, where I was still living. If I don't have a job, I don't have money, I can't keep my home. Will my only option literally be to basically move back to Finland
And the
after I have
UK
built my
has
kind of.
no problem sending people on planes these days.
Yeah, unfortunately.
More political dark humour. Sorry, you were telling a story that actually matters and is the purpose of this podcast.
But yeah, so basically that's the point I got to. And while I Finland is a wonderful country, I always encourage people to visit. It's beautiful, especially in the summers and the winters. But for me, it's because I did move here when I was 19, so fresh out of high school. I have lost touch with a lot of my friends from back in the day, and I've moved here. I built my network here. Most of my kind of in office professional work history is here. My friends are here, so obviously for me it was like I have built a life for myself here. So the thought of I'm gonna lose everything and I'm gonna basically have to move back to Finland to live with my mom and then basically try and find a job there, it just felt like the worst case scenario. So when the Oxford University press job came up, I was like, okay, I am willing to put my dream of working in the games industry aside again and take this job. And the way I kind of approached that while it sucked a little bit, but because I was then already looking into getting into marketing jobs, and Oxford University Press is obviously a known name. So I was approaching it in a way like, okay, I'll take this job. Maybe it will be then easier for me to get a games industry job in a year or two. Now, when I have some of the marketing experience and I have a known organization on my CV, even if it's not games.
Okay, I think that makes a lot of sense. I feel like I can get the steps in that journey, and I think it's just again to reiterate, it's just about like you made the decisions that you had to more than you wanted to, and that is the epi like that is the epitome of just having to make choices to survive, I guess, like survive and not thrive, and I you know what I mean. Because platitudes. So let's turn the dial in a little bit more and talk about some of the cool beans. We see the opportunity, super rare games. What were you thinking during that like interview process? Like, we thinking like, is this it? Is it finally gonna happen? Like.
It's very kind of cynical and very pessimistic to say, but because I'd been applying for 3 years at that point, not constantly, but pretty on off, and I'd been rejected probably by like 100+ jobs in the UK. So at that point, I was pretty much like, oh, I'll apply for this, but I don't have very high expectations because everyone else has turned me down. But then I had the interview at Super Rare Games, so I was first interviewed by George Perkins, who is the founder slash CEO of the company, although they hate being called the CEO. They absolutely despise that word. But I was first interviewed by then, and it was immediately one of the best interview experiences I've had, because it's like at Super Rare Games, what we do is part of the interview is what George literally calls a vibe check. So it was literally just us talking about like, oh, what makes you like games so much? What sort of indie games have you played recently? What are some of your favorites? And I remember in particular, we talked about Life is Strange for quite a bit because it was something George at the moment was playing with their brother. So I left that immediately feeling like, okay, these are some nice people, some people that seem to genuinely care, and it wasn't overly corporate and stuff. And then my next interview was with Ryan Brown, who also works in the marketing team. And that again, it was supposed to be the more kind of professional interview because he was then to be my manager, so it was a lot more kind of marketing focused than I had done like a task for them before that. But again, it felt so laid back. I felt so heard. And Ryan, who actually also comes from a working class background, we quickly learned that we actually have a lot in common in terms of our upbringing and stuff. So we immediately kind of felt connected by that. And nowadays, Ryan is literally my best friend. But yeah, after that interview, then I put together the money to basically go attend EGX for a single day. It was a big sacrifice for me because I was struggling financially. Also, I was sick on that day when I went there, but I was
Oof.
like, okay, I feel very confident about this, so I'm gonna make the effort to go to EGX because Super Rare Games had a booth there. So I went and attended the event, and Ryan even kindly invited me to like industry drinks that were happening after, which were industry only, but he still invited me, which probably should have given me the hint that, oh, I'm probably gonna get this job. And the funniest thing is, I actually left those drinks, and I didn't clock it until Ryan mentioned it later. But when I was heading off, Ryan literally accidentally said to me, "Oh, I'll see you soon." But I didn't clock it like at all. And Ryan mentioned it after I started, like, "Oh yeah, the day you left the drinks, I literally said to you, 'Oh, I'll see you soon.'"
Okay, no, that's cool. For totally listeners' benefit and not my own, what exactly is EGX, or at least what does it stand for?
Oh yeah, of course. So EGX is, I don't actually know what the acronym stands for. Is it an acronym? Electron, I don't know. Anyway, EGX is basically the biggest kind of games event in the UK. So think of in the US like PAX, obviously way bigger, Gamescom, many, many times bigger, but it's basically the equivalent of those in the UK. It's hosted in London yearly. It's literally like a games event. People have booths there. People can go there, play games, and industry folks can go meet other industry people. It's basically like a video games convention.
Excellent. Definitely didn't know exactly what that was. Like one of those things, like, I know what that is, but I'm not sure, so I'm gonna ask. So, if you've listened to the show before, you might be like, this seems like a slightly altered usual format, and that's partly because A, this is an important part of the conversation, but also when you speak to industry folks, I'm well accustomed to, I can't talk about that for NDA reasons. So, can you talk to us a little bit about what you can tell us at what is cooking at Super Rare Games?
Of course. So at the moment, like I mentioned, we've announced our digital publishing label last January of last year, and since then we have released four games. Yes, four games. So we started with Crapple Dog in February of last year. Crapple Dog was actually recently nominated in the MCV Awards for the Accessibility Innovation of the Year, and it was the only indie game in that category. We
Love
didn't
that.
win, sadly. We didn't win, sadly, but we were very proud of the developer, very proud to be nominated in that category. So that was our first game. Then we have released Lone Ruin, which is a kind of a roguelike twin stick shooter kind of game. We released that in January of this year. Then we did console ports for games, a game called Post Void. It's kind of, we describe it basically like Doom on drugs. It's the kind of psychedelic first person shooter. I am terrible at it. If you have migraine, maybe don't play that. very hard game, but we did that for PlayStation and Switch.
Sorry, I really was like Doom on drugs, because like Doom is like one of those things that can be slightly trippy, like if you really get like into it, despite its age. Sorry, I was really distracted by that. That's what I'm gonna like check that out a little bit further.
Yeah, look at yeah, it's very very colorful, very hectic. All the creatures look like something from a like a sleep paralysis demon sort of thing. It's very
Oh, that
I'm
sounds
doing great
terrifying.
great marketing for the game.
Oh, but like, yeah, but like, now I want to play it. Excellent
You can
marketing.
get it for the cost of a latte. It's very cheap on PlayStation and Switch.
Well, we love that, especially again in this economy. Also, I'm, a poor PhD researcher, so, as a member of my Twitch community once said, always buy your indies at full price in AAA games on sale. Never do the way around. Anything else you can sort of give us the scoop on, or?
Yeah, so the other two games we actually two, one, yeah, or set three. So the one more we released is Ocho that we released on the 20th of April or 4/20 as some
Hey.
people would like, hey. And that was actually so the first game I was the marketing lead for. So I managed the kind of marketing budget and marketing campaign for the entirety of that game. And not that it's all thanks to me, but that is currently our best-selling game that we've released since
I
we
would
started
call
digital
that a
publishing.
classic example of correlation equaling causation.
Yeah. But yes, so that's what we have out. In terms of things that are coming out, and now I need to be careful because not everything has been announced. Well, by the time this podcast comes out, it will have gone out on Twitter. in the upcoming Wholesome Direct in June 10th. We
Wait,
may
hold
have
on, hold
something.
on, hold on. This is gonna go out in May.
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay, all right, just checking. I don't want to get myself in trouble. Don't want to get you in trouble.
That's fine. The tweet about the Wholesome Direct has literally gone out just before we started recording this,
Okay.
so this is all good. So in the Wholesome Direct on June 10th, don't remember the time off the top of my head, we may have something new to show about a game of ours called Townseek, which is a wholesome exploration and trading game. So if that sounds like something you're interested in, keep an eye on Wholesome Direct on June 10th.
Can I send you my money directly?
Yes.
Okay, excellent. We'll do that. We'll get that sorted. We'll do that after the show. Yeah, because that is my type of business. So to sort of nitpick, because I like to be informed on these type of things. I also love learning, so I spent too long in academia. But like, what? So marketing. What does that look like? What does a typical day kind of look like? You said you did an entire marketing budget for a game. Tell me more. I'm fascinated.
Yeah, marketing, I think, is probably the one of the most misunderstood just fields in general, especially in games. There's a lot of especially in the kind of the indie scene, where it's like, okay, you post a meme here and there on social media, and then you'll get tens of thousands of likes, and your game will be a complete hit. Very unlikely that that's going to happen. Wouldn't bank on that. So that's where kind of marketing comes in, and a lot of what marketing is actually not something that the consumer sees. Like when people outside of marketing think of marketing, they think things like, social media, commercial, social media ads, things like that. Yes, that is part of the job, but what a lot of marketing is actually just research and data. A lot of my time is spent on things like I go on Steam, I look at games that are similar to games we have coming up, I look at the reviews for those games. Look at what type of audiences, what kind of other games audiences play. I look at pricing of some of like our competitor games, and literally write fun spreadsheets or fun documents about basically competitor research.
Research, data, fun spreadsheets with, like, you're speaking my language, Annie. This is, yes.
Yeah, but so it's literally, so a lot of marketing is that kind of back end stuff. So yeah, looking at data, like looking at wish list numbers, thinking of how you can bump up those wish list numbers, speaking to press about various coverage bits, speaking to partners like PlayStation, Sony, Xbox, Unity, whatever, talking about any upcoming opportunities. And then, yes, a part of that is also then things like community management, social media management, paid ad campaigns, although those are done, I think, less and less these days, unless you are someone like Devolver who has millions and millions of dollars in marketing budget. We unfortunately don't have that. But yeah, the way I like to say it is that marketing is pretty much 60, 70% of all that kind of research stuff, and then 30% of implementing that research into like action.
Pardon my dog joining in the
It's fine.
podcast. Sorry, pardon. He gets very passionate about marketing, apparently. He does this. So obviously, we like to talk about work and things. And you've told us as much as you can. But what do you like to do when you aren't working? You've touched on it. We talked about your booty pics. I mean, sorry, not just the booty pics in anime.
Yeah, so there's, I guess, for me, I can talk about my genuine hobbies that have nothing to do with games. And then I do stuff in games outside of my day-to-day job. So if we start with the stuff that I genuinely have nothing to do with games, then yeah, I do powerlifting. I train 4 or 5 times a week. I'm one of those crazy people, or wild ones who wake up. So on the days I'm going to the office, I am waking up at 6:15 in the morning to go train in the gym, and then from there I go directly into the office in London.
Do you like, have you ever lifted a colleague? Is what I want to know.
I have not lifted a colleague, but I could probably lift a few of them. So if we're talking pure numbers, and I apologize, I only know kilograms, so anyone who works with pounds will have to convert. But if we're talking about a basic barbell squat, I can do 115 kilos. So anyone who is under that, I can probably squat you. Then there's this exercise called
I'm
going to
get, like, I can probably squat you. I want for you on a t-shirt.
Yeah, and then there's an exercise called a deadlift, which may not say anything to people outside of lifting. Some sort of limitations. If I was able to bench press a, let's say, 80-90 kilo man, then I
Sorry.
no worries. So if I was able to bench press a 80-90 kilogram man, then I would probably be an Olympic athlete. So unfortunately, I won't be able to bench press most people unless you are 50 kilos or less.
Okay, that makes sense. And I think, so again, just because I like to define, learn, understand. Because powerlifting is like a thing, like typically you might see it on, like, I don't know, World's Strongest Person, you might see it at the Olympics. But, like, I think a lot of people get that confused as just you go and you're doing reps. But it's very specific in its aims, and you're not just doing, like, you know, hundreds of reps. It's about, like, the physical mass, right? And achieving those higher goals.
So with and the other thing that often get used interchangeably but are completely different things is bodybuilding and powerlifting. Those are completely different things. So that's the one thing I always like to emphasize is that so bodybuilding, they are strong as heck because they are very muscular, but where bodybuilding is ultimately all about aesthetics. So bodybuilders are those people you see on stage with fake tan. They probably have about 5% body fat, if that. So that is bodybuilding. So they just want to look as muscular as possible, as lean as possible. Whilst then you look at powerlifting, and that's nothing to do with aesthetics. There are people with various body types in powerlifting because powerlifting is ultimately just about how much you can lift. So those are the kind of two different things. And with powerlifting specifically, it is, yeah, like you mentioned, it is about goals. So for example, for me, wanting to compete in like amateur powerlifting someday, it's basically what you do is that you get measured in squats, like I mentioned. Then there is the deadlift that I also mentioned, and then a bench. And basically in those contests, what you do each of these three, and then the winner is the person who has the highest combined total. So, for example, if you're better at squatting than deadlifting, you can compensate with that. Or if you're better at benching than one of the other two, you can basically compensate. But yeah, in like powerlifting, it's mostly focused on those specific exercises. And to get to that point, so I work with a personal trainer who does my workout. So I have very, very specific things I go to the gym to do rather than just, oh, I'll turn up in the morning and I do what I feel like doing.
So you're definitely one of those people I look at the gym and go, I won't bother asking them if I can use that machine because I'm too scared.
I promise I'm very friendly, although in the gym I do have a headphones on and I do have a bit of a murderous stare, but I promise I am very friendly whenever people actually talk to me. I just completely zone out when I'm working out.
Well, I mean, generally, I so this is maybe just me being overly filled with etiquette and also aware that I'm a straight white presenting man, but, like, generally just speaking to anyone at the gym is something I try and avoid.
Yeah, I mean, to be, I can relate to that. Yeah, I mean, I don't like being spoken to and I don't speak to people, but at the same time, I don't mind if someone does that to me, unless it's in the middle of my set and someone is being very rude to me, which happens from time to time, especially being kind of feminine presenting, assigned female at birth. So there are the occasional gym lad, as they're called, that comes up to me, tries to give me advice, or tries to tell me to speed up so they can take over the machine, only for me to then see that they're not even lifting as much as I am.
They're, like, lifting, like, a quarter of the weight for Instagram pics, and you're like, what are you doing, bro? Like, come on. Like, okay, so that's, I feel like I've learned a lot there, and that's really cool. So you do that, you do powerlifting. What else do you do for fun?
Yeah, so we talked about anime. I'm quite an avid kind of an anime consumer. I also read manga. I'm also studying Japanese language at the moment. I started it when I was still at uni, then I kind of fell off the wagon during the pandemic, and now I'm trying to get back on it. And then, funnily enough, I do less and less gaming these days. I think it's probably quite common across the board in games. Like when you start working on them, you play less of them.
I read and write more about games than I play games nowadays.
Yeah, pretty much.
But I research games.
Yeah.
Make it make sense.
So that So that's kind of the completely not related to games stuff
So
that I do
we
as
gotta
adult.
unpack the anime a bit more because I still haven't gotten over the not just booty pics comment. What? Because again, I am one of those vanilla kind of anime consumers, like your Dragon Balls, your Yu-Gi-Oh's kind of thing. And I also just love. I think we need more like animation for adults. I think it's a thing that we've seen grow a little bit. Things
Oh
like
yeah, absolutely.
BoJack Horseman and things like that.
Oh, love that.
So like what type of anime are you into? What's good? What should people be getting onto?
Anime recommendations are very difficult. I recently saw, I think it was a rapper. I don't know anything about rap. I'm into metal, but I think it was a rapper who was like, "Oh, a good entry level anime is One Piece." And even people who do not watch anime may know One Piece, and One Piece is that anime series that currently has 1,000+ episodes. So to recommend that as a starting point to getting into anime, don't take that advice, basically. And
So
I say this
I
as
was
someone.
into Bleach back in the day when it actually was in a consumable number and then vastly got ahead of what I could consume.
Yeah, and I thought I read One Piece. I don't watch One Piece, and even that is over 1,000 chapters. So it's definitely not an entry level thing, unless someone is really heavily into binging things, in which case go ahead. But as a gateway anime, I would not recommend it. But yeah, it really depends on what sort of medium you like in general. Because the thing with, I think there's a lot of misconceptions around anime. A lot of it, I think, is people who have no idea what anime is think it's like this over the top nonsense, or it's this big nonsense sort of thing. So, boozies or like doing very questionable things with clearly underage characters. I think that's an impression a lot of people have about anime. But the thing about anime is there's so much variety. I guess Your Name is a good example. It's an Oscar winner, complete amazingly beautiful film. I saw it in the cinemas, and I also recently saw Suzume, which is from the same director. It's basically a work of art, but like with any kind of viewable media, so films, TV series, anime also has genres. So if you like thriller, you can watch thriller anime. Some great examples are things like Psycho Pass. One my favorite anime of all time is called Banana Fish.
Okay, I have questions. I'm not sure I want the answers to those questions. But I'm also curious.
It's a spoiler if I tell you.
Oh, and that makes me so much more intrigued.
It's a very underrated anime. It's basically talks about like gangs in like New York City and like how they get mixed with the mafia. You wouldn't guess that from a name, Banana Fish, but again, it's a spoiler if I give you context. So yeah, that's thriller. If you're into your romance or drama, there's things like Fruits Basket or things like Sailor Moon, which is a classic. If you like your action stuff, there's things like One Punch Man, My Hero Academia, or if you want something older, things like Bleach and Naruto, but they are tremendously long. And then there's things like A Slice of Life, which is basically just supposed to be like this chill kind of stuff you can watch. It doesn't have much action in it. It's just basically a slice of life. So there's things like March Comes in Like a Lion. That's probably the best example I can think of. So it literally just comes down to what kind of genres do you enjoy?
And again, I think that's actually illuminating for a lot of people because I think they do see this anime as like a separate other. Because you're
Yeah.
quite the connoisseur, this is maybe a loaded question, but how do you feel about things like, Studio Ghibli being, vastly absorbed in like mass media? Like, I feel like anyone can kind of appreciate those. How do you feel about that being kind of like the touch point for anime?
Well, I am one of those people that I don't really mind. I know there's a lot of this kind of, oh, you watch the normie stuff of anime, and I'm like, I don't, if it's good and I enjoy it, I don't care if it's the most, like, if it's the nichest show out there, although I might be a bit sad the more people don't know about it, or if it's the most popular thing out there. Like, I read One Piece. It is probably the number one most popular manga slash anime series in the world at the moment. But for me personally, if you enjoy it and that helps you get into more animes, then brilliant. The Studio Ghibli movies are a perfect entryway. Like, I think one of the first animes I ever saw was Spirited Away, which is also an Oscar winner. So I see absolutely nothing wrong with that.
Such a like a nice, well-rounded, candid answer. I love that. So when on rare occasions you do get a chance to play games, apart from obviously super rare games, what other stuff do you play?
So my favorite franchise of all time is Final Fantasy, and literally all my tattoos. I have a few of them. I have actually not all anymore. I have one that is not Final Fantasy related, but I have three tattoos that are Final Fantasy related. And if I were to say, it's basically probably my favorite franchise of all time. It's my kind of comfort series. Whenever I'm feeling down or I just need to play something familiar, I usually go and play Final Fantasy. but outside of that, what other series I really like
I do
when it
wanna
comes to
apologies again for interjecting, but I do feel like we were approaching this point of maybe I was really gonna step brothers it and be like, have we just become best friends? But we've just become best friends.
Yay.
Are you live on air? You saw this happen because I don't mean to flex, but I may have beaten Final Fantasy 1 through 10 in my lifetime. So
That's good
you can
because
gather I'm also a big fan of the series.
I've only done 7 to 15. So I've still yet to play 1 to 6 because I have this grand dream. I could now buy the pixel remasters, but I have this big dream that one day I'm gonna have a streaming capable PC and I'm gonna stream through every single Final Fantasy game that's out there. But currently I have a crappy laptop that is secondhand, clinging to its last bit of life. So currently that is not possible.
Okay, fair. Okay, but no, sorry, that like yeah, Final Fantasy. Love that. Big fan of it on the show, big fan of it on stream. I've even like streamed like a few like challenge runs of seven and things like that before.
Oh, brilliant.
So yeah, it's you know, I mean I'm literally just plugging myself, but like I've done some panels at PAX East on Final Fantasy VII. Like, you know,
Oh.
like it's a huge thing. Big fan. We'll talk about that off air. All good. Other franchises you're into?
So something I've kind of learned very recently is that a lot of the franchises I'm really into tend to be Japanese. Again,
What a
probably
shock.
have it is. But yeah, so I also really like Resident Evil. Recently played the 4 remake. Absolutely loved it.
I
Fighting
remember the
games.
original Resident Evil 4 on the GameCube. It was on two discs back in my day. Ugh.
I think I played it once when I was younger, but I was very, very young. then, what else? I also like Silent Hill. Very big fan of Devil May Cry, Bayonetta, Persona. Persona 4 is the best. I am willing to argue over that. Kingdom Hearts. What else?
Metal Gear Solid.
I have, funnily enough, never played any Metal Gear Solid game.
Okay, so you need to go to season one of this podcast. Listen to, I think it's episode 9 with my friend Marco, aka Solid Snake. Go and listen why Metal Gear Solid is incredibly important to him. And if that doesn't sell you on the series, I don't know what will.
I'll keep that in mind. I funnily enough, I quite have quite a few series. For example, so I grew up, and I've talked about this on Twitter, for example, I grew up as a PlayStation household, and because we were a working class family, we could barely afford our PlayStation 1. So I never had a Nintendo console growing up. So people are always very shocked to hear when I'm like, oh, I've never completed a Mario game, haven't played Metroid, haven't played Zelda, none of the Nintendo franchises, haven't played Kirby, you name it, I haven't played it. And even on like PlayStation or something like Metal Gear Solid, we had a lot of demo discs growing up. I still have some of those PS1 demo discs, and I am very proud.
Nice.
I actually have demo disc number one, which has that dinosaur animation thing that you can. So a lot of those kind of traditional series. So I'm pretty sure one of those demo discs would have Metal Gear Solid on it, and I may have played it, but I never had the full game. And that was a lot of my gaming experiences growing up because we could only afford a selected few games, and because my sister was also very in, and still is very into Final Fantasy, so those are the kind of games you would then put money into.
So I think again, I kind of resonate with this myself. I think again, when you think of you have limited disposable income, so you want to make good, smart choices. So I feel like I would maybe get like one new game a year, like two kind of like maybe like one birthday, one Christmas kind of thing. But like I would want a game that I know I would get the most value out of in terms of time. Yeah. So I would always go for a JRPG or like a Pokemon or something I know I was going to get volume in, right? Because I think, and this is what I still sort of take with me now, in that per pound I put into a game, I would like an hour per pound back. So you, you mentioned like a Fabulous Super Rare Games game that was the price of a latte. I'll most certainly get that hour per pound value back. Whereas in a day and age where you can buy a AAA game, like I'm not picking on the series, right? But like something like a Call of Duty where it's a £70 game plus DLC, the story campaign is about 6 hours because the emphasis is playing online and playing other modes. Like I would maybe struggle to get 70 hours out of it for the type of game that I enjoy. I am also, you know, blind and suck at FPSs, so I tend to play story mode on that type of thing. So you see why that might not be my jam.
Yeah.
So I resonate with that a lot.
Yeah, so I think I play quite a lot, big variety of games. I think online, like online multiplayer is the one genre that I just am not into, which is a disappointment to a lot of my friends who are like, Annie, you need to play Final Fantasy 14. And I'm like, A, I don't have that much of time in my life. B, I see how addicted people get to that game. I don't want to get sucked into it. And three, I just don't play online games. It's just like, if I play online, it's with my friends on a Discord call, but I don't personally enjoy the experience of something like, I don't know, Fortnite or Call of Duty or something. It's just not for me personally.
Again, I would also really love to play Final Fantasy 14, but like both accessibility and also I wish I had the time. Like,
yep.
I feel like that's going to be the kind of thing, like maybe like post PhD, I'll like, you know, take like trying to get like an extended break and maybe play it. But then I'm also planning to do that for like, you know, 7 Rebirth. So swings around about games are coming out quicker than I can play them nowadays.
It's a, yeah, it's a pretty
problem
much
of being, you know, in my case, old. So I've got to ask you the question though. What is your favorite Final Fantasy out of the ones you've played?
10, easily. It's my favorite game of all time.
Oof, okay, that was really like no hesitation, bang bang. Like, defend your choice.
Well, first of all, it's the very first game I have distinct memories of playing.
Classic so, impact factor. Okay.
Yeah. So this might be the peep where you're like, ugh. But when the game came out, I was 3 years old.
Oh, no. I remember that game coming out. I'm so old.
But yeah, so that came out when I was 3 years old. I was a toddler, literal toddler. And I remember playing it in my like parents' bedroom. And my sister had specifically told me, do not touch my Final Fantasy. I fear you're going to save over my safe. I didn't save over her safe. But I played it. I understood absolutely nothing. I didn't know what I was doing, but I had a fun time doing it. Just hammering the X button, running around Zanakend, taking on that final boss, which is literally just a tutorial. You cannot die for in it. And I basically, from there on, I think I play Final Fantasy, probably not to completion, but I played pretty much every year. And it's given me so many kind of other things. So in my like teenage years, I made a lot of friends do like Final Fantasy forums who were really into Final Fantasy X. I literally started learning graphics design because of Final Fantasy X, because I wanted to make cool graphics I could post on Tumblr when that was a thing.
Good
things. I got way more into creative writing because of Final Fantasy X, so it kind of ties into a lot of things. Also, it's a brilliant game and a beautiful soundtrack.
It is very good. I think it's a really interesting choice as well, because like it's one that I think is really quite complex. Like, I remember playing it when I was younger and like, you know, finishing it off, and like I can't quite say doing a playthrough, but like, you know, watching someone do a let's play, and like, there's a lot of like really complicated like political and religious nuance that goes on in Final Fantasy X that like is quite explicit. And like, that's like bold for when it came out, you know? Okay, so I'm gonna challenge the question a little bit more. That's your favorite, that's completely fine, doesn't matter.
Yeah.
What do you think is the best one that you've played? Like, if you're gonna try and like add some objectivity. While you think on that, I'm going to defend my choices. Is Seven is my favorite, one of the first ones I played, one of the ones that made me think games could be more than just go left to right and have fun. But I think Nine is objectively the best. It contains all of the best parts of the series. The characters have distinct classes. It has your really great side quests. The world map is fun. Has the best Chocobo side quest. Has a banger
Oh, that's cool.
soundtrack. Freya, in of itself, Vivi are just in of themselves selling points that just go for the game. And I think it truly like has that essence of what Final Fantasy, is, if that makes sense. And I'm saying that as someone who played like, four, did play a tiny bit of six, seven, eight, nine, onwards.
Yeah, well, if we're thinking objectively, I might be kind of inclined to agree with you because also in terms of like lengthwise, I think it's quite accessible compared to some of the other games because it's not that long. Even if you do absolutely everything the game has to offer, I don't think it's like even 100 hours, if even that. Whilst if you do a full run of Final Fantasy X, easily up to 160 hours, because there's funny things like you can rebuild the entire sphere grid, which is going to take you hours upon hours of grinding. But yeah, in terms of like accessibility and things like that, I think Nine, yeah, probably agree with you that Nine might be the best, although the card game is terrible.
That if they had the card game from eight, I think everyone would be happy. I'm excellent. I'm agree. You heard it here first. Final Fantasy IX, objectively the best. Excellent. Ten also banger. So also like whole bunch of other series in there as well. I think what are you most excited to play next?
Well, it might genuinely be Final Fantasy 16. That might be the game that I will have to buy a PlayStation 5 for, which is actually next month. I don't know if I'm going to be able to do that, but I will attempt. So that might be the closest upcoming release that I can think of. It would have been Resident Evil 4 if we had recorded a bit earlier, but that's now out. I played it, very much enjoyed it. And then after Final Fantasy 16, I'm a boring Final Fantasy fan and say the next one I'm most looking forward to is probably Seven Rebirth.
See, that's the game that I'm going to hope to steal away a PS5 from one of my friends who owns one for like a month and just like do a lot of that. Just really get into it. Because I've not like, I'm not 100% out, I'm not a completionist by any means. I think I have like seven or eight platinums on PlayStation. Never been motivated, mostly because there's always another game I want to play. But I got the platinum for Remake. I knew I'm gonna do the same thing on Rebirth because no matter what it takes, because it's just a matter of pride. I've just got to, do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
Driven.
I on the other hand have a platinum for all the games except for the Pixel remasters and Final Fantasy 13. But I have a platinum for 7 Remake, 8, 9, 10, 10, 2, 12, 15.
Okay, how did you? How many controllers did you break in the process of getting the jump rope trophy?
Two.
Honestly, lower than I was expecting.
I think that trophy alone makes that platinum the hardest out of all the Final Fantasy games. I will grind the entire sphere grid in 10 times again, but I will categorically refuse to ever again do that skip rope to 1,000 jumps. I absolutely refuse to do that.
So again, for context, there is a jump rope mini game where you jump over the rope that you have to do within like it's within like the first hour, right? Wait, no, hold on, you can go back and do it, right? Am I?
Yeah, I think disc 3, well, remaster don't have discs, but I still talk about discs. Disc 3 of PS1.
You
You can go
have to
back to
do
it.
it specifically, like at specific points, so you can access one of the cities, and you have to do 1,000 jumps consecutively. But like, it's not programmed well, so like the speed changes, it doesn't have a rhythm. Like, which is worse, dodging the lightning bolts or doing the jump rope? Everyone says jump rope.
Oh yeah, the lightning bolt's easy because there's a spot in Thunderblaze that you can literally keep looping around to get always hit by the lightning at the same exact point. With the jump rope, there's controller delay. It's badly programmed. It's badly timed. It's just a nightmare. Like, I'm convinced a lot of it will just come down to luck. It doesn't matter how good you are at it.
And I think you'll possibly agree with this opinion. It's one I've heard from a few communities, including that of Death Unites Us on Twitch. But like Square, particularly with Final Fantasies, are just bad at doing trophies.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I think the seven remake trophies weren't particularly bad. Then I think 8 is just too easy. They either make them really difficult or too easy, and I think 8 is very simple. I mean, I guess some people like that, basically just complete the game, get all the GFs, which for anyone not familiar with Final Fantasy 8 doesn't mean girlfriends, unfortunately, but means guardian forces. But yeah, it's usually one extreme or the other with Square. But I think Remake had a pretty decent trophy list. There was some challenge there, like playing the game through again on the higher difficulty.
Yeah, that beating the battle chamber as well, that was fun.
Yeah.
Good times. I'm very tempted to replay Remake, and I don't really have the time to, but I also really want to. Just like a new fresh file ahead of Rebirth. Might do that, might treat myself. Anywho, we're going off topic. This is a podcast, I'm a host. Okay, so one of the other things I always like to ask is, have you like played Red or anything, you've viewed anything recently that you sort of like want to give a shout out to? Like, we were talking anime recommendations and stuff, but anything that you're like, oh, you might not have heard or seen of this, you want to check it out?
Yeah, so I briefly mentioned it previously. So I recently saw the anime film Suzume, which is from, if anyone has seen Your Name, it was quite big. Well, obviously won an Oscar, and I think it's the highest grossing anime film of all time now. So it's from the same director, and I saw that a couple of weeks ago in the cinemas. It might not be in the cinemas anymore, but I would imagine you can get it on demand on various kind of rental services. But it's basically these films are difficult to explain without spoiling them. So it's about this girl who lives in kind of a small rural town, and she basically meets this guy who is bit of a, like, of, I guess you could call him like a guardian. So his job is to keep these sort of doors, as they call them, closed. And if they don't, there's these beasts that come out of those doors and basically cause earthquakes, which is a very kind of interesting way of explaining why earthquakes are so frequent in Japan. And the reason it was particularly touching to me is because I am quite invested in Japanese history. So if there's people who are kind of know the Japanese history from the past, like kind of 10, 15 years, there's references to a particular, well, disaster that happened some time ago in that film that personally touched me, because I've read stories about people who were impacted by it. And I think it gets quite beautifully referenced in the film. And I don't think you need to be an anime fan to watch that film. It does have some like quirky anime moments, but I think it's really just a piece of art. It's like you would go see the latest Disney, but I think personally better.
Okay. I'm like, you know, Annie, she keeps selling me on these things. She's saying these things in such a tantalizing way, and then I'm like, of course you work in marketing, that's literally your job. I'm like, of course, like, this is why I've got my credit card out ready to buy things after this episode. Like, and you should too, check it out. Okay, that's cool. I'm gonna look out for that. I love a good recommendation. So this is sort of a couple of like my sort of favorite questions that I get to on the show. But if you had no limitations whatsoever, what would be your big blue sky project? So you have infinite access to time, resources, people of your choice. What would you do?
This is a really tough question for me. I guess I have like two answers. One of those would be like a game I would like to work on. It's not necessarily even, this is a studio I want to work on, but a project I would love to work on. So if we were talking about a game and I had infinite money, is I would basically like to make a Persona-like game. So people who have played Persona, those kind of game mechanics that are in that and all those like building relationships and stuff. So a Persona-like game, but with an adult cast. So rather than high schoolers, they would be adults. It would be an RPG, but it would also be a horror game. And it would have that kind of Persona-like mechanics in it. I think Parasite Eve is like a horror RPG from like early Square days, but I have never played that. So basically, a horror RPG would be my like dream game project to do like marketing or maybe even writing for.
So, like, Persona meets It, Stephen King's It, kind of like adults facing fears, scary stuff, sandwiched together.
Yeah, something like that. Atlus has this other, they have a puzzle game called Catherine, which has an adult cast. So basically just take an adult cast from something like that and just plant it into a Persona-like gameplay and then have adults with adult problems. I cannot really relate to high school romances and things like that, so
Yeah,
that
I
would be
think
my.
that sounds cool. And I think, again, like, Catherine is, like, a really good, like, touch wing, because that's one of those games that, like, you wouldn't necessarily want to buy with a responsible adult in the shop, because it's definitely designed to look overly sort of sexualized. But, like, while it's got that kind of anime, kind of, like, booty pit kind of element to it, the actual point is that it's about addressing, like, adult problems in, like, a jokey sort of sci-fi way, which is, is a cool way of kind of looking at it.
So that would be my like dream game to work on. But if I could work on just anything, I would probably, I like the games industry. We could go do a whole other podcast about the issues in the games industry because there is loads. But if it was to do like something non-game specific, then I would probably, so I am quite passionate about like diversity and inclusivity, which I haven't spoken too much about in this podcast, but if we have time, I can talk about all that stuff that I'm doing in games. But if I
Yes.
had the infinite yes.
We make
So if I
time.
had the if I had the infinite money, then I would probably like to do some sort of kind of diversity and inclusivity work specifically for games. Either maybe it would be like, it doesn't maybe sounds too exciting for some people, but for me it would be like do some sort of consulting to companies and all that sort of stuff, which isn't the most exciting work in the world to some people, but for me that would be like amazing because I could get to work in games and I could do more to try and make the industry a bit of a better place basically. But unfortunately, at the moment, I don't have the capabilities to kind of go off my on my own to start doing that sort of work. But maybe someday.
Starting a company, who's got time, you know?
Yeah.
Okay, excellent. So then my next question is extensively reading notes. I don't know why I know the question, but I was like, trying to get to check this is right. So, on the back of that, we talked Blue Sky Ideas, but is there anyone or any sort of group of people that has inspired you and that you want to give a shout out to? Because I think, we talk about this journey of how you ended up where you are and why that's informed what you're doing. But I also think it's nice to really give like a shout out to some of the great people that have maybe impacted or influenced that in any way.
Well, the person I always like shouting about, especially on Twitter, is Ryan Brown, who is the kind of, well, we all have difficult titles at SuperRare, but he's kind of the biz dev person slash our PR and communications director sort of thing. But Ryan, especially because we do come from similar backgrounds, has inspired me not only as someone who does come from that background, but also as just a person who we should all kind of aspire to be in the games industry. So Ryan has been in the industry for over a decade at this point. And he frequently, when I talk to other people, everyone just talks about how Ryan is so like, first of all, he's very non-businessy, which is why a lot of indie developers we speak to really like Ryan because he's very approachable. He's also just incredibly kind. I don't think I've met a person who has said a bad thing about Ryan. He tends to be quite universally liked. And despite having been in the industry for so long, he's just incredibly humble, sometimes to a fault. Like he could ask for a lot more kind of credit and even praise for the work he has done, but he does what he does out of just genuine passion for the games industry, and he's particularly passionate about like small indie developers. So Ryan has this kind of passion project called The Mixtape, which SuperRare is publishing, but we make no money out of it, and it's literally just like really, really small grassroots game developers from sites like itch.io that we pay to be on a mixtape. We give them visibility, we pay them to be on a mixtape, and then they can get their games not only physically preserved, but in the hands of customers. And these are games that probably would never otherwise be seen by consumers. And Ryan is really passionate about kind of helping these sort of small indie developers. And I just, yeah, I often say, well, Ryan hates what I say, but I want to be like Ryan when I quote unquote grow up, even though he's only 4 years older than me.
That's amazing. I am conscious of the fact that you're slowly getting more eradicated by sunlight.
Yeah.
Do you wanna like change your lighting situation? I don't want you
Yes,
to
if you
like.
don't mind,
No, that's fine.
I can quickly close.
I will filibuster in the meantime because I had the pleasure of meeting Ryan, so I'll chat about
Yes, I'll close my curtain.
that. Say, so gotta think about the guests on this show. But yeah, I had the pleasure of meeting Ryan at the same event at which I met Annie. Very lovely, genuinely seemed like a great human, and is one of the people that I get, I think, the majority of my gaming news from on Twitter. So Ryan, all round sort of good egg, I would say, from my limited interaction. And I do, you know, when you just like you meet someone, you're like, oh yeah, they seem cool. You get a really good vibe. He was definitely one of those people. And also, if I remember correctly, had a really cool Omari costume at that party as well, which was really, really dope. That was me filibustering. Annie's back, so that we can have some more conversation. But yeah, no, I think that's nice, and I think it's just really nice. I always like look forward to the answer to those questions more than any other on the show because it's really heartwarming to hear people talk about like people that they think are awesome. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I also look like I think I really might turn that into the clip of like Ryan's who I want to be when I grow up because that's excellent.
Yeah.
So EDI then, equality, diversity, and inclusion, something that I'm very passionate about. Let's talk about that. What are you doing in regards to that at the moment? How can I help you with it? What can we do to make that a bigger thing? Because it's something that I feel the world, let alone the game industry, needs.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I do a lot, and I probably did a bit too much last year, to the point that I probably burned myself out a little bit, but not to dwell on the negatives. So basically, as soon as I started in the games industry, which was December 2021, so I've now been here for 1.5 years, which is hard to believe because I've done so much. But pretty much the moment I started working on something that I am now hoping to maybe launch this summer, exclusive scoop.
Yes.
So I am currently working on a project that is aiming to specifically support people who are new to the games industry. We have a definition with it, so I have a whole team working with me on this, and we're basically aiming to establish a community for people who are new to the industry, and may would like to meet other people who are new to the industry, but would also like some sort of networking opportunities. Because what I found when I joined the games industry and spoke to other people, especially after the pandemic, is that you are new to the industry, you go to games events, and it is terrifying, because you meet these like industry veterans, and they in some ways they almost feel like superstars, so to speak. It's like, I don't know how to talk to these people. They've been in the industry for 10, 15, 20 years, and I am here with my 1 year or less experience, not knowing what I'm doing. Very intimidated, and especially then when you mix something like social anxiety or introversion into that mix, it can be very overwhelming. So the project I'm working on is hoping to kind of help people first to meet each other, so they know there's other people who are new to things, and then there's me and my lovely committee there who are also still relatively new to the industry, but who are willing to then do things like, for example, we have a plan of maybe organizing some sort of a get together at Develop Brighton this year, where we can be like, hey, are you new to the industry? You want to come to a mixer networking event? You can come to ours. And then we w might also welcome like industry veterans who are keen to meet people who are new to the industry and come talk to those people who are new to the industry. So that's something that is not, I've spoken about it a little bit. I can't reveal the name or anything yet because we're going to do a big launch thing, hopefully relatively soon. So that's what I've been working on. Then another thing that's actually how we met. I started Game Devs North, which is really funny when you realize I don't live in the north. I live near London.
All the more reason to start something northern. You know what I mean?
and that Game Devs North started completely accidentally. And it kind of ties into the other projects I was talking about. So, and again, also kind of my working class background. So games industry is very southern heavy in the UK. And I would just, I think in the US, it's very coastal. But focusing on the UK, a lot of events are in the south. Develop Brighton is literally Brighton. You cannot go more southern than Brighton, pretty much.
You can't, that's a fact.
EGX that we talked about earlier, again, London. WSD, which is an indie-specific games convention, also in London. There used to be a thing called REST. That was a games convention in Birmingham. Unfortunately, it doesn't happen anymore. WSD kind of replaced that. So there's really nothing there up north. There's like small things, but there's nothing really big there. Again, completely accidentally, last August around Gamescom, I wasn't lucky enough to go. But I was like, I still want to meet people, and I know other people are like FOMO or fear of missing out, as it's called. I was like, okay, I want to do a meetup. I put up a simple Twitter poll, and I was like, if I were to do a games industry meetup, would people prefer London or would they prefer Manchester? And Manchester won that poll by quite a bit. So I was like, okay, I'll do something in Manchester. And I did two things. One of them was a kind of a gathering in a pub, in a pixel bar. I have quite a good relationship with them now. I've organized quite a few things with them. And the other one, because I wanted to be as accessible as possible, and I know people may not like going into bars for various reasons. So I then did a picnic on a different day in a park where we just sit down, talk. But what ended up happening there is that it really kind of blew up on Twitter. And I ended up having people who were in Cologne in Germany at Gamescom being like, oh, I wish I was at this thing in Manchester, but I'm in Cologne in Germany.
Sorry, part of my brain is just having to, like, I would rather be in Manchester. Like, wow, okay. I'm gonna leave that. I have some great friends from Manchester. I have nothing particularly against Manchester. It's very grey as a city. But like, I guess FOMO is that real, I guess.
Yeah, so that happened. That it was supposed to be a one-time thing, but then people came back to me and were like, "Okay, Annie, when is the next one?" And I was like, "Oh, I wasn't intending to do a next one." Then I got an idea for a Halloween party, but I realized like, "Oh, I will get very overwhelmed if I'm doing this by myself." And that's where the lovely Rosie from Safe in Our World stepped in and kind of joined Games Dev North with me. And we put together the Halloween party. And for context, people who may not know this, probably a lot of people won't know this. So we did a Halloween charity party again at Pixel Bar in Manchester, where we were raising money for Safe in Our World. And that was quite successful. We sold out the tickets for that event, and literally every single like all the profit we made from that went to Safe in Our World. So what's very important for me in terms of Game Devs North is that I could genuinely take a cut because it is quite a lot of effort for me to especially go from London to up north, but I don't. So we were very lucky that the Halloween party was sponsored by Luminal Games. So they covered our venue, so we could just then donate literally all the tickets proceeds to ch charity. And from what I heard and what I saw, and I'm sure Christopher can comment on his behalf, I think people really enjoyed it, and people have already asked if we're going to do another one this year.
And as the winner of best costume, it was an excellent party. My personal ploy of attaching business cards to Milky Bars went really well. It was a great time. I think because the thing is, like, you mentioned this, like it, the games industry feels so southern centric. It feels like, I mean, I being from the north, like people say, Chris, it's one train, it's 2 hours from, Liverpool, London, but like that train costs easily 50, 60, 70 quid, and then like if you
If
go
you're
into,
lucky.
if you're lucky, then if there's any sort of like, if it's gone after 8 o'clock, you're gonna have to stay in London, that type of thing. And like, there's a genuine level of inaccessibility to it. So to have like a northern sort of base thing, I mean, I know like there's a I'm cross branding here, but like there's a Game Dev Network in Liverpool, which I only found out about like last month, and I'm like, because it, it I'd sort of always known it, but didn't like know it, and that Liverpool actually has a really big game dev community. You know, there are loads of really cool studios. I'm like, why do we not celebrate this more? You know, like, why do we not make the most of this in terms of, like, you know, London? Like, I know, you know, companies have, like, I'm trying to avoid naming too many names, but, like, you know, ran by Leeds and in the north, like, it exists, they're there. These are companies and publishers whose games you've played that are nearby. So it definitely kind of baffles me that we don't do more, and I think it's really cool to see people doing it in a way of me sort of sticking my nose in as someone who is industry adjacent. I try and convince myself I'm part of the gaming industry, but you know, I then like rub shoulders with people like yourself, and then I'm like, I'm definitely on the outside looking in, but I want to be on the inside of the building.
Well, for me, it's another one of those Twitter discourses that happens every year. What is a game dev? A lot of people would say I'm not a game dev because I am not a game developer, but I think, like, as long as you're contributing something to games, like, I would say that's, like, you are in the games industry. So that is journalists, that is educators. If you're contributing something to video games, for me, then you are in the games industry, and I don't care how much other people like to argue against that.
Well, I feel personally, I feel personally validated, so that's an excellent thing for me. Anything sort of else like EDI you'd like to talk about? As I say, it's something I'm very passionate about, I think, in spaces.
So outside of those two things, which are kind of the, I guess, the named things of things that exist as something, I am quite heavily involved in Safe in Our World, which is kind of also how we met. Rosie is one of my closest friends in the world, not just in the industry. And I've been quite heavily involved in Safe in Our World pretty much since its foundation. I believe I was one of the first people to do any sort of fundraising for them back in like 2019, December. I raised a couple of £100 because I was quite heavily involved in like the video game society at my university. So I raised a couple of £100 there, and I've been kind of involved ever since. So now I'm actually an official ambassador this year. So that's something I'm involved in. You. and then actually as part of my job, although I don't get to contribute as much time to it as I would personally like, I am in charge of like the accessibility policies at Super Rare Games. So since I started, we've like made our marketing way more accessible. I have told our community manager that if they don't include alt text into all our posts, I will come after them. They are now including alt text in all of our posts.
Just threaten to lift them. Like, listen, mate, if you don't do it, I will lift you.
So I've implemented that, and then I'm currently also working on doing things like color contrast checks on things, for example, like email marketing that goes out to make sure that people who have any sort of visual impairments can actually read what's like on the screen, so it's like the colors aren't too close together. In terms
I love
of like
being able to
stuff.
Read things. Love that.
And then things like just making sure that like the text version of our email looks and reads okay, because I think a lot of companies just kind of ignore it because very few people actually use the like text plain text version of the email, and the auto-generated one is awful. So I literally just manually check every single email that goes out. And then just on like a wider scale, I am hoping to get more involved in like looking into like accessibility in our games and just like accessibility of our brand in general. So it's something I don't have that much time to work on at the moment, but I am hoping that I will maybe when things calm down a little bit. It's a busy period at the moment. So that's another thing I'm doing. And then I like to do I am very lucky to have quite a wide network as someone who has been in the industry for only a year and a half. So when you take that into consideration, I know quite a lot of people, and I acknowledge that I'm very fortunate in that sense. So I like to use my network for things like fundraising whenever I can. So literally just today, I announced this thing called Safe Spaces, which I did last year as well. So Safe Spaces is one fundraising campaign I run in June to raise money for Pride, because it's Pride Month, for any kind of LGBTQ+ causes. Last year, we raised almost £5,400 for a charity called AKT, which is a charity in the UK that is helping basically LGBTQ+ youth that are either in danger of homelessness or already homeless. So that's what we did last year. And today I've announced kind of part two of that, I guess. And this year we're hoping to raise money for a charity in the US that is basically fighting for LGBTQ plus rights in, well, across the US. And if anyone has read any news recently, they can see that especially trans rights are getting absolutely like destroyed in the US at the moment. So I figured that would be a good cause for this year.
The US are not doing great when it comes to the rights of anyone that isn't a straight white cis able dude.
Yeah.
It's not, don't like to see it. Don't, no, not a fan.
Yeah, so that's what we're doing this year. And basically what Safe Spaces is, that is literally we're raising money for charity. And while we're raising money for charity, people can take any sort of fitness challenge they want. And it's really literally open to anyone regardless of their fitness level. Like last year we had, I myself ran 100K in the course of the June month. Hate running. That's the only way I can convince myself to do running. Not in a single go call.
No, but even so, 100K is still quite a lot.
Yeah, I hated it. The only way I can convince myself to run if it's for a good cause. But there was people who did it because they genuinely enjoyed it.
Also, I feel like there's that added dimension because, like, what I do know of fitness is that, like, running like that is counterproductive to, like, powerlifting goals, which adds, like,
Yeah.
that extra layer of, like, torture to it, I guess. Like, that's really charitable giving on every level.
Yeah, so there's, but yeah, so that's one of the kind of more extreme things that people did. But there was one person on the campaign, for example, who lives in San Francisco, and what they did in June was they literally just made a, they just walked every single day to a different kind of LGBTQ plus landmark in San Francisco because there's lots of them in there, and then just wrote a small tweet about it. And that was their fitness challenge. They got some steps in, and then they got to learn something about local history. And then there was literally everything in between. There was a person who, there's a machine in the gyms called the Stairmaster, which is literally an infinite staircase. They climbed Mount Kilimanjaro by using the Stairmaster. And I don't remember, it was like 250,000 stairs or something.
I have used the Stairmaster. I would rather take on the actual Mount Kilimanjaro.
So, yeah. So there's basically, it's open to everyone. We have a lovely Discord community. So if anyone listening to this is keen to join in June,
The
the
links
tweet
will
is
be
up on
attached
my.
wherever you found this episode.
Yes. So yeah, please join us. It's literally, we had like the community last year was lovely and no one got judged on what they did. Some people had a simple goal of like, oh, I want to walk 50,000 steps in June. And that's fine. You don't have to be a marathon runner or very, very heavy power lifter person like me. Literally everyone's welcome. If you want to help raise money for charity, you are welcome. And if you cannot come up with a challenge, the community is there to help.
And I'm sure as a charity donation incentive, if you weigh less than 100K, Annie will lift you.
I'm sure that can be arranged.
I'm not judging what anyone's into. I'm just trying to help raise money for charity. Okay, that's all I'm doing. Okay. No, that's great. It's something I'm very passionate about, and I love hearing about other people who are passionate about it. And you know, I'll put my hands up and say I'm more passionate, maybe more than active, and that's just because, you know, doing a PhD,
Yeah.
nonsense.
Yeah.
But to hear people who are actively doing stuff, it just, oh, it really makes me really, really, really happy. So as we sort of wind down then, one of the things I like to do is a quick fire round.
Pew pew
Pew, pew, pew. You are going to a biome of your choice. Because I personally wouldn't go to a tropical desert island. Have you seen me? And you're going on a bit of a retreat. On that retreat, you are taking with you one film, one album, one book, and one video game. If it comes as a physical collection or comes in one set, you can have that. So, like, you know, for example, the Pixel Remasters collection, you can physically buy it as one thing. You can have that. The game and its DLC, etc. What are you taking with you and where are you going? What type of
Oh, where
biome,
am
I
I go
guess?
Oh, where am I going? I guess I would be going to Japan, but if I were to take stuff with me that I want to consume while I'm there, I wouldn't be going to like Tokyo or anything. I would go like
It's
Japanese countryside.
a biodome of that ilk. So it's kind of detached.
Yeah, I would go to Japan, but to be fair, I would also like I want to see the big cities in Japan, but I also want to see the lovely countryside and stay in like an onsen or an inn, and just relax, look at the beautiful countryside. But with that out of the way, that's where I would go. One film, ba, 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 ba.
You can
I
also
would
have TV
probably.
shows as well. I'm flexible.
I am bad with TV shows. I'm good with anime, which I guess count as TV shows. But name any recent TV show, I probably haven't seen it. A film. One of my favorite films is Grand Budapest Hotel. So let's say I'll take that.
Nice.
One album. I'm gonna say Meteora by Linkin Park because it's a very important album to me. One book. The Hunchback of Notre Dame by Victor Hugo is my favorite book of all time. Very grim, not a pleasant read. Don't read it if you're looking for a good time. And a video game, Final Fantasy X, and we've already talked about it.
I want that as like, if I ever write an autobiography, I want that to be like the line, the foreword. If you're after a good time, don't read this. That sounds
Just
great.
that single paragraph and then turn page.
Yep, just like, if you're willing to sign it off, I just think that'd be great. Okay, no, that's great. I think some solid choices. I love the way that you were like, you kind of felt very assured. I've had people like, even though, spoilers, I send the questions out in advance, who like get very panicked once I get to this part of the episode. So that again, that assurance, very good. Love to see that. Touching on the album, you said you're into metal. Any sort of like other close contenders that were maybe up there?
So in terms of albums, not really, because I'm the kind of music listener that I have a playlist on Spotify that's rather mix of artists and songs and albums rather than entire albums. But if we're talking about just whole albums, the only other close competitor would probably be Sempiternal from Bring Me the Horizon, which was quite impactful to me as a teenager, since I was a teenager around that time the album came out. But if we're talking about just like artists, one of my favorite artists at the moment is a band called Blind Channel, which some people may or may not remember as the Finnish Eurovision entry a few years ago. I am also really into a German band called Electric Callboy, which I actually saw live a few weeks ago, probably one of the best concerts I've been to because it felt like a mixture of a concert and a rave. It was brilliant. I've never seen audience so engaged at a concert. Everyone was having a great time, and they did things like a cover of Let It Go from Frozen, beautiful. I've posted a clip of it on my Twitter if anyone wants to see that. But then there's another Finnish band that I'm really into, well, which actually released a album literally, I believe, last week called Cyan Kicks. That's not metal really, that's more kind of rock, alt rock sort of music. I always try to recommend it to people because I don't think they have made a single bad album. I think all of their songs are brilliant. And it doesn't have any of the kind of screaming that is quite common for metal, which I know is painful for a lot of people listening to screamo or any kind of yelling. Cyan Kicks is brilliant. Good vibes, can recommend to anyone. But yeah, I think those are probably some of the contenders if we're ignoring Linkin Park and Bring Me the Horizon.
Okay, nice. I always like music again, another one of my passions, so I like to ask about it. So, peel that back a little bit. Some good choice.
Oh, yeah.
So the last question then is I like to turn the tables upon myself and I ask, is there anything you would like to ask me? Again, for full clarity, I've had the what are you doing with your PhD question. The answer was not the same both times I was asked that. And the biodome question myself. But is there anything that you want to ask me?
Okay, brilliant. There's a few things, but if we go back to what you just said about being really into music, do you play an instrument yourself?
I was wearing flannel shirts before it was cool, and obviously I'm a white presenting man with a beard, so of course I play acoustic guitar. I don't quite do the whole full like you're at a party, everyone's kind of like has taken some substances. There's a guy with an acoustic guitar who won't stop playing. He's now looking at you. He looks a bit like a pervert on a bus kind of thing. Haven't quite reached that level. It's like anyway, here's Wonderwall. I'm definitely at the
Oh,
campfire level,
yeah.
where I enjoy it more than anything. There's definitely like an unlisted playlist of like my jams on YouTube that I occasionally send to people. But I enjoy the process of playing and, like, you know, sort of like writing lyrics more than like I would to, like, you know, perform. I've done an open mic night once. That was fun. Take that off my bucket list. Because I play and sing, and like I can play like a smidge of harmonica. So, like,
yeah.
I really go for like the Bob Dylan kind of sound with that. So, like, yeah, it's just something that I really enjoy. I don't get enough time to do it. I feel like because of work commitments, again, in this economy, I feel like I always have to like interchange what hobby I do.
Mm-hmm.
And like guitar sometimes just gets put on the back burner because, like, any skill based thing, you don't do it for 5 minutes, you're then really bad at it, and it takes a while to then regain that kind of mastery, unfortunately.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So I asked that question because, well, I played the bass for about 6 years. So I started in like elementary school, and then up until high school, I unfortunately had to sell my bass when I moved to the UK because it would have been expensive to bring with me. But I have recently been thinking about maybe getting back to it. But after having not played for 7 years, like you said, I would probably have to learn the basics again.
It always comes back to you. It takes a little while for that. So we can also start a band. So we really did become best friends on this episode, I think.
Oh, perfect.
Because I've also got an acoustic guitar, because of course, acoustic and an electric guitar. So you layer those sounds together, we'll get some drum beat, we'll be flying. Yeah. Excellent. There we go. We're sorted. Rosie looks like the type of lass that can smash some drums. I bet she'll be able to do it.
Yeah, you know, that you mentioned, I'm sure she could. She has, well, bending anger like we all do. She looks like she could.
I'm going to leave that one alone. I'm going to let you comment because you are good friends with Rosie and I'm not.
I can send her this clip.
what you mean? She's going to definitely watch the episode? How could she not? Okay, all that remains for me to do is, you know, Annie, just say thanks for being on the show. I really appreciate this. It's been a great chat. I feel like I've learned a lot about things that I didn't know I would learn about, which is honestly why I do the show, because it's more for my own entertainment than anyone else's. So yeah, thank you for adding to this plethora of knowledge and sharing your experiences with us. I think it's a thing that people maybe take for granted because there's just so many like sort of podcasts, but having someone come on and, you know, I will let slip, you mentioned this was your first podcast appearance. You know, you've done exceptionally well. Love that.
Oh, brilliant.
You know, to just come on and just talk about stuff. It's not an easy thing to do. So thank you very much. Is there anything else you'd like to say before we roll credits?
Well, first of all, just thanks for having me. Like you said, it is my first time. I believe all the times that whenever I go to events, Safe in Our World spots me and Rosie puts me in front of a camera. Maybe that has done some good. So yes, thanks for having me. It's been really lovely chatting with you. And I hope the people listening will also enjoy these waves of discussion that we've had. We've gone some wild topics to more wild topics in the past 2 hours.
Exactly. And obviously all the links will be attached wherever you found this episode. Where is the best place for people to find you? Your Twitter, I believe you've mentioned.
Yeah, so Twitter is the place where I'm chronically online the most. So if you want to follow me up there, drop me a DM, just stay in touch. Twitter is the easiest place to do that.
Excellent. Right. Annie, thank you so much. For those watching along, I'm going to click on the ending screen button now. Thank you all for listening, and I'll see you again next time. As always, as we say on this show, until next time, look after your mind, body, and soul. Bye-bye. Well, thank you so much for listening to another episode of Psyched to Be With You. I hope you enjoyed it just as much as I did. If you did, do please leave a review wherever you listen to your podcasts. It really helps. Otherwise, check out the description of the episode for the links for the guest, but also to keep up with information about the show and myself. I really hope you enjoyed this listen. Until next time, take it easy. Look after your mind, body, and soul. And I'll see you again for another episode very, very soon. Bye-bye.